Hi there. You're listening to Currents and Religion, a podcast brought to you by the Department of Religion at Baylor University and by Baylor University Press. I'm Zen Hess. Thanks for listening today. Did you know that Baylor's Religion Department has a very active and well-respected ministry guidance program? It helps prepare undergraduate students to enter into ministerial vocations through classes that invite deep reflection on Christian ministry and by partnering students with internships to give them practical experience. In fact, my first year in the PhD program, I served as Dr. Eric Holliman's graduate assistant. He was a legend among ministry guidance students. And rightly so. In today's interview, I speak with the person who stepped into Eric's role when he retired, a legend in the making, if you will. That person is Dr. Susan Benton. Susan is a colleague and a friend, having recently earned her PhD from Baylor's Religion Department in the New Testament area. She is an outstanding scholar, as you'll hear. Her research focuses on women in the New Testament and the Greco-Roman world. It's really interesting work, and her pastoral gifts have encouraged many doctoral students who find themselves in the throes of coursework or dissertation writing. I know that from personal experience. She started as a full-time lecturer in religion and ministry guidance this fall. Here's our conversation about her research on women in the New Testament and Greco-Roman world and her work in ministry guidance in Baylor's Religion Department. Dr. Benton, thank you so much for joining us on Currents and Religion.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit of your story. How did you wind up in the role as a lecturer in the religion department and in ministry guidance?
So I started off my career work in ministry itself, and I myself was an undergraduate who was majoring in church-related, you know, I was a religion major, but I did first, intercultural studies. I thought about doing biblical studies, but I wasn't ready to take Hebrew then. So I put that one off. And I did Greek, but did like a practical studies, pastoral ministry emphasis. So I did that for a while, and I worked in ministry for about 10 years after I finished my degree at a couple different churches and really loved it, but also did kind of have a seed planted by a professor of mine from undergrad suggesting that maybe I think about studying the New Testament. And he actually said, you should come back and take my job, which I have not ended up doing, but I have kind of followed in his footsteps here.
Yeah. And sorry, so before you keep going, yeah. 10 years in different churches, what kinds of churches were these?
So I started off in a Baptist church that was affiliated with Conservative Baptist Association out in California. Okay. And then I also then worked at a Presbyterian church that was PCUSA, but then became ECO. But that was after I had left. So yeah. I was there when it was affiliated with PCUSA. And then for a little while, I was just volunteering while my husband and I were at a non-denominational church. Mm-hmm. I did take a little break there to have some time at home with my kids, which was great. Right. So after all that, once the kids were kind of at a different stage and I knew, okay, I want to get back to work, I just knew that was my time if I wanted to try to pursue New Testament. So I applied to Duke, ended up going there for a THM in New Testament to kind of get my focus more particularly. Back when I had been working in ministry, I had done my MDiv while working. So kind of, again, took some time there. It was not the shortest MDiv program. and then I was able to come to Baylor for my PhD, which I felt really blessed to be able to do. So that all brought me here. And when I did my dissertation and was graduating, this job came up in ministry guidance, and it sounded so perfect, like a blend of what I was already doing, teaching Christian scriptures and heritage in my fifth year of my program, And, you know, kind of going back to the students who are in the place I was in my undergrad program, thinking about a life in ministry, trying to prepare and, you know, getting to teach them just sounded like, oh, this could be a dream come true.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a long shot. I applied and was really excited when I got interviews.
Yeah. Oh, well, we're so glad that you did get it. So fun that you're here. Say a bit more about your research.
Yeah. So like many things with me, I started one way, expecting to work on Luke and economic ethics and analysis. And then we had this one course on Greco-Roman associations, so like ancient clubs, and it's a whole subfield within New Testament scholarship, for those of you who might not know. And we were reading just various documents from these ancient clubs, and I was captured by this one character in one ancient inscription, and her name was Salvia Marcellina. And I just was struck by how this woman who did not seem to be a noble, you know, wasn't particularly known for any other reason, was very prominent and influential in her association. And I was struck by how her name seemed to be highlighted above her brother-in-law, who was also part of this, even above her husband, who was, everything was sort of established in memoriam for him. There was just all this that she had done, and essentially she like set the terms for her association and how it would run. And I thought, this would be really useful, I think, in comparing to women like Phoebe and Prisca, and even, you know, Euodia and Syntyche, the women of the New Testament who we know were influential and involved in local congregations and other roles in leadership, but we don't know exactly what they did.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, maybe if we tried to understand, are there other women like Salvia Marcellina? Can these help us to think about what they were doing? Because I, you know, people are still asking the question, what could women do? How much were they able to, you know, serve in leadership in the early churches? But I also think there is a growing consensus, at least among New Testament scholars, that they were doing many things. Like Paul acknowledges them. And even though we have sort of our problem passages that we have to deal with that seem to restrict women, I think really we need to keep asking the question, you know, not just could they do anything, but what were they doing and what can we tell about that? So that was really what I set out to write about just in a paper, and then it turned into my entire dissertation project.
So what did you find about women in these ancient associations?
Well, I found that Salvia Marcellina is not the only example. There are other women, and her particular role is really interesting because she is, like I had noticed, a non-elite woman. This is kind of a classical term that we borrow in New Testament studies because it is hard to sort of delineate social classes or, you know, the strata of society because it's not the same as ours and it kind of runs by its own rules in different locations. But there is a sort of an idea that some people are elite in their own location. Other people are non-elite.
Mm-hmm.
And she wasn't an elite. But we have other women who were more elite, sometimes connected with people who had a Roman rank, but sometimes in the provinces, they just were sort of a part of the local gentry and aristocracy that went back into an older Greek period. And a lot of those women, the really elite ones, were patrons to associations. So they were giving some money and sort of, you know, signing some checks and then being honored for that.
Yeah.
And the associations seem like they were just really glad to have a nice name attached to them. Mm-hmm. That's part of the donation. And then that was the extent of the women's involvement. But I was really fascinated by these mothers who are part of these clubs and appear to be members in the clubs.
Yeah.
But they then have this honored role where they have some official duties as part of them. And so it seems like sometimes they were presiding over different events or like a statue raising for a patron, say.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an example of this woman named Licinia Macedonica, who is like the one who runs the ceremony for the patroness of the association. So this one place has like both a patron and a mother. But then there are other women like Salvia Marcellina. What I found is that, you know, she's not the only one, but she is kind of the maximal position for like the most we have seen of what a woman did.
Right.
And, you know, she gave a huge endowment, determined the location for where her group would meet. She kind of set the terms for membership, the cap for membership, how they would replace members who were deceased, what the members had to do to remain in good standing. The way the inscription talks about her, it's like she decided all this and laid out the rules. And I just thought this is really fascinating and gives us some more detail about what the administration of a group looked like and what a leader might determine about how a group would operate.
Right.
So that then what I think is we can use those as good analogs to compare, okay, when leaders of Christ groups were coming up, so we call them Christ groups when we're talking about them in association terms, you know, everybody else is like, the early churches were like Christ groups. So when we're talking about these Christ groups, we're picturing that maybe the women who were leading, the ones that, you know, we know they were part of. And then also some of the men, we know some men who are also leaders of church groups, that they might have been doing the same sorts of things, figuring out, you know, where is it going to meet? If it doesn't meet in a house, maybe it meets in a location that they have available to them.
Right.
And then, you know, who, how many people can be members? What's really practical and doable? Maybe then we would imagine that it is that leader who decides, okay, we are getting too big. Now we need to have, you know, a daughter group start over here, in the same way that now we would imagine kind of a, you know, a daughter church emerging out of a mother church. So that was what I sought out to do, was explain, you know, how these women could help us to think about the New Testament women. And then because we have one woman named as a patron in the New Testament, I thought, okay, let's really think about what could we say about Phoebe. If she's the only one that we know of in the New Testament who gets called a patron, and we have like a special category of these women patrons, what might that suggest about her? So
interesting. You were listening to Currents in Religion. I'm speaking with Susan Benton about her research and her work in ministry guidance at Baylor University. Before we return to that conversation, I'd like to tell you about a new book written by Gary Dorian and published by Baylor University Press. The book is titled Anglican Identities, Logos Idealism, Imperial Whiteness, Commonweal Ecumenism. In this intellectual and political history of Anglicanism, Gary Dorian shows that the Anglican Communion's present challenges are the upshot of a centuries-old clash of Anglican identities. Dorian contends that Anglicanism has been sort of ecumenical from the beginning, with a radical ecumenical aspirational vision, and in its liturgies and teachings has embodied and enacted an idealist approach to the claims of the Christian theological tradition. But Dorian urges that these features of the Anglican story are deeply at odds with English Anglicanism's entanglement with white colonialism. As Baylor University Press director Dave Nelson puts it, the book destabilizes the standard way of telling the Anglican story. You can find a link in the description to learn more about this new title from Baylor University Press. All right, back to my conversation with Susan Benton. Your research helped prepare you to be a lecturer in religion. That's one part of your role. The other part of your role is to be a lecturer in, and a member of the ministry guidance team. Could you explain what the ministry guidance area of Baylor's religion department offers students and what the ministry guidance team does for the department and its students?
Yeah. So our ministry guidance program is a way for Baylor's undergrads to be able to come in and indicate either that they think maybe they'll be a sort of bivocational minister, and so maybe they're taking religion as a minor while they have a business mm-hmm. or other type of major, or if religion is their major, they can major in practical studies, and that will prepare them to go into work in the local church. And while we still would encourage them to pursue seminary, go further in their education and their preparation, with an undergrad degree from Baylor's Ministry Guidance Program, they do start off with kind of a sense of, you know, what does ministry look like in a mm-hmm. local church, and what are some core, you know, core keys for studying religion, but also interpreting the Bible, preaching and communicating in a congregation. So for a student that is their focus and they are a religion major, oftentimes they'll be able to take, you know, communication and practice preaching yeah. and get feedback on how to preach, how to research for a sermon. For students who are, you know, interested in trying to think about important issues facing churches, they can take women in ministry and try mm-hmm. to understand where are we coming from theologically when we're talking right. about the question of whether what roles women can serve in churches now. And so for every student who comes through, they all take intro to ministry. So part of my responsibility, I get to teach that class most semesters. And it's been so fun. I had not taught that before this semester. So I'm learning just ahead of my students yeah. about our particular books and, you know, things that we are doing. But it's a great chance to be able to walk with them through their own vocational discernment, thinking about what their call looks like, and then kind of understanding what the basics of ministry are while they also do a practical internship. Cool. So they're reporting back about their work either. We have all sorts of internships. It's kind of fascinating. So some in local churches, some of them are working in adult ministries. Some are working in like counseling or marriage ministries. I have one with a local counselor, so in a private practice. I have one who's helping out with a legal services nonprofit here in Waco, and they're helping out there. I have some who are helping in the missions department because they're hoping to do work in missions in the future. So just they're all over the place. Yeah. We just try to find and match them with some of our mentors in the community who've worked with us in the past, trained to be a supervisor. And then those students have a chance to gain some practical experience, too.
That's awesome. I would love to hear you talk just a little bit about how you think that your research relates to your work in ministry guidance.
Well, for me, part of what, you know, got me really excited about this was thinking about how my research is about how people lead in churches in the ancient world and what that might have looked like. I cracked up in, you know, some reading early in the semester where it said something about, you know, the original structure of New Testament churches. And I just laughed, like, there is no such thing. I mean, we don't even, this is like one of our questions in the field right. is, you know, we hear about the ecclesiae in the New Testament, but we hear very little about what exactly they did. You know, we know right. they had like the Eucharist, this is important, and they baptized, but that leaves a lot open for like, how often are they meeting? We know mm-hmm. scripture is important, but how do they, you know, how do they use scripture? How are they right. learning and teaching it? After, you know, Acts 2, how do they like learn the apostles' teaching and pass that on? And so we have lots of questions about this. So I love to be able to talk with my students about, we have a lot of possibilities
yeah.
and then in Christian tradition, we have so many different expressions of local churches and their ministry. And so when we talk about what ministry can look like, there is a lot of, you know, we have a lot of resources to look at, both in our traditions for what is normal to us and pretty well established, but also we have examples that show that we have some freedom to be innovative and creative right. and responsive to our environment and to new challenges. And so I love being able to take what I know about the early New Testament environment and early Christianity and the women too, mm-hmm. and then talk about that with my students. And for a lot of people, you know, we've kind of grown up with churches that have their own stances or practices about women, but a lot of our students, I find out, don't always entirely know why it is that, sure. you know, we're taught about a particular role or some roles being open to women and others not. So I like being able to be part of that sort of challenge for them to mm-hmm. discover this for themselves, to think about it, to ask good questions. I mean, I obviously have my opinions, you know, but and there's a role for that. I can try to persuade a little bit, but I'm also trying to help them to
right.
look at the information themselves and come to a conclusion that they can feel good about,
yeah.
you know, for their yeah. life, their ministry. And whether that's about them and their call, like it was for me when I was an undergrad, and that was a real issue. I came in from a tradition where I thought I could be a missionary or a pastor's wife. I mean, yeah. and when I wasn't engaged, I figured, well, missionary, you know?
Yeah.
So it wasn't until I was in college and really had a chance to study the scriptures and even learn more about that the tradition I had been raised in, I learned it actually did support women in ministry. That just was not what I had seen.
Oh, right.
So I think for the women, it can be maybe both freeing but also challenging, because maybe God would call you to be a senior pastor, and that sounds really overwhelming. Mm-hmm. It's a big responsibility. And for the men, I think it's to think about, how can you be a person who allows the women in your congregation to serve according to their gifting and your own convictions about
right.
what God allows, what God wants for that?
Yeah, great. So as an early career scholar, you're nearing the end of your first semester of full-time teaching. What have you most enjoyed?
Well,
you named a few things that you've enjoyed.
I know.
I don't want
yeah.
to pretend like this has to be novel, I guess. But
no.
Yeah.
I mean, it is fun. It's fun to feel like I am getting to reconnect with the passing on part of the
sure.
work, you know, that, you know, all of us who are going into academic scholarship, most of us are not just going to like work in research, even mm-hmm. if that's a component of what we do. But I did spend a lot of time in research, you know, the last couple of years. I was always teaching some, and now I'm teaching a lot.
Yeah.
And so it's just exciting to have more students that I'm able to connect with. And then I do really love bringing back in my ministry experience.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's strange to realize, I don't know, how many challenging situations I got exposed to. At one point, I was putting together case studies for a class period on a very difficult subject. And I had a ton of ones that I knew about personally, like from, you know, people I knew or
yeah.
churches I had been a part of. And I thought, wow, that's, you know, sometimes discouraging because
right.
the case studies are sometimes problems, but it's also, I feel like I'm able to make use of it, invite mm-hmm. them to think about how can we transform these things? How can we
yeah.
make our churches stronger, safer places, you know, healthier places?
Yeah. And what's something that you think you'll do differently in future semesters?
Well, it'll be interesting. It'll be nice to not have a prep that I have not taught before. I mean, it'll happen again. I'll have another course that I haven't taught before. This one, I mean, I finished my dissertation and graduated in August and started teaching in August. So I didn't have a lot of time before the semester to
right.
prep for my one prep. I think I will enjoy getting a little more lead time in
yeah,
the future.
That makes sense.
You know, just to like read the books way ahead of time. As it is, you know, sometimes I'm sitting with my kids while they watch a show and I'm doing some reading,
mm-hmm.
which is normal. This is academic life too. But
yeah.
It will be nice to have a little more advanced time for the prep. I'm not sure. I would like to. I mean, I have a 4-4. Many professors have a 4-4 and are also expected to do research. So I think I'm going to pick the brains of some of my colleagues who are in that situation to find out how they pull that off, because that to me seems like a pretty amazing feat. I do want to carve out a little bit more time for research, some writing, because I just enjoy that. So hopefully I can learn from some people who are a little ahead of me and are doing that better.
And maybe that relates to the first bit that you mentioned about not having a lot of lead time.
Yes.
Maybe as you get more comfortable with the classes that you're teaching, you'll have just a bit more time, but we'll see.
Well, and I think, I mean, all of it, you know, it's a blessing. Like, I wouldn't trade it all, because I'm starting my job earlier than I thought I would get to.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, as much as I was applying aggressively everywhere last year, I think we all just know to have moderate expectations and hopes when we're doing the application period. And so, you know, we have contingency plans for how we'll write a lot longer you know, extend the program as long as we keep applying places. So I feel really blessed that I did get to start right off, and that, you know, my committee was amazing working with me through the summer to revise and edit my dissertation to finish. So I'll have a little bit more prep time, you know, lead up to the summer, all those things next year. That'll be fun.
Well, Susan, so good as always talking to you. Thanks for joining us on Currents in Religion.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you to Susan for making time for this interview, and to all of you for making this episode a part of your day. If you enjoyed the episode, share it with someone else who might enjoy it too. And if you haven't already, subscribe and leave a review. This will help people find out about the podcast in the future. Until next time, take care.